In American history, the colossal figure of Abraham Lincoln stands against the background of his age, a time when great currents stirred the young republic. In the century of his birth, greatness, and death, religious zeal mingled with sectional disputes, the meaning of free labor, and the dawn of progressivism. It was a century of transformation, most powerfully so, because the evil underlying contradiction of slavery brought the country to a bloody catharsis, the Civil War, with results that still play out in our time. My guest is Vernon Burton, author of The Age of Lincoln. Vernon, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Oh, I should thank you for writing a marvelous book. I'll just begin by saying it that baldly. It's a marvelous book, Vernon, and I'm holding it up for all to see, and in the hopes that all will read it. And it's marvelous for me for a number of reasons. Let me just give you an overview of it as a reader. First of all, the centrality of slavery throughout. I've never seen a depiction of the 19th century in which it was brought so much to the fore as the dominant force and issue that it was. You also depict that century, and particularly the first several decades of it, as kind of an age of ambition and anxiety, and an age in which, in those early decades, there were this great religious millennial concern with perfectibility. I'd like you to comment on that, because it seems to me the Americans were swept up in that fervor of perfectibility, but it wasn't necessarily an inclusive fervor. What's your comment on it, Vernon?
Well, I would agree, George, and I think your term, the anxiety, is exactly right. And scholars such as myself, for years, while we had focused on slavery, we might have overlooked other anxieties that were at the heart of American society. I think there was probably more concern initially that how could the West, without those settled institutions of the East Coast, fit in to this new country that's really an experiment in liberal democracy, as well as capitalism, as that plays out. And then capitalism itself becomes a great concern. The idea that people, to make a republic work, to make a democracy work, they could not be beholden to other folks. So you had to be independent. So you couldn't be working for someone. Mm-hmm. The tradition had been that artisans would be in a household, but they would work their way up, and then they would become a householder and start the process with others. Now you have factories, and you, with those factories, you have young children, 8, 10, 11, let alone grown men who, when young children are faster, they lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. They're not independent. This is not even speaking of slavery. So there's a great concern about mammon and wealth, the disparities of wealth. All of these things are going on until I think the focus really does come down to the great imperfectibility in society, slavery. But I wanted to add, it is a millennial age. It is an expectation. First, the millennium that Christ will come back. When the date is predicted, the Millerites think he's coming back. It doesn't happen. They sort of turn away, and throughout society, it gets tied in with who we are as a nation. Mm-hmm. That somehow we, as a nation, the United States, can perfect society. And certainly we see all the utopian movements, but people forget that these refined fanatics, and they were fanatics, white Southern slaveholders also had a millennial vision. And that millennial vision was that the perfect society was one with slavery.
That brings me exactly to my very next question, that their notion of perfectibility would be that they would transform this evil into a notion of essentially good. I mean, they would, it's almost mind-boggling. Account after account in the book shows how they would believe this. But Vernon, clearly this that kind of thinking and that welter of transformations at work in the country, competing passions, must have led, and I think in the books you point out, did lead to this growing sense that this country was going to splinter. It simply had to sort of splinter on these issues by the middle of the century.
Well, I think there was always that concern, but at least what I learned in this book, George, is that when people believe that they are doing God's will, that they know God's will, they're doing God's work, compromise can't be worked out. And that's where I think Lincoln, with his own faith, is so fascinating. I honestly believe he was the greatest theologian in the 19th century, because while everyone else claimed they knew God's will, Lincoln understood that we don't know God's will, even if he might be using us to work out his plan in history. It's a subtle difference, but a major difference that sets him apart from the rest of the age.
I want to turn directly to Lincoln because he is, of course, the pivotal figure of the age. The fulcrum, I think, is the word you use for the way that the 19th century changes in American history. Before that, though, Vernon, I want to address another specific point in this story as we progress from that millennial feeling at the beginning of the deck of the century, and then the disappointment as these things begin to splinter and conflict. In 1856, on the floor of the Senate, we have this extraordinary incident where Senator Preston Brooks of South Carolina assaults Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. Now, in your words, Vernon, and I think it's very accurately depicted here, is that a turning point?
I think it really is. I think it inspires or renews the Republican Party. It could have easily gone the way of all the other parties, the anti-Masonic Party, so many different ones. But I think it clearly is a turning point when Brooks caned Sumner on the Senate floor. It shows how the two sections have different understandings of the event. One is seen, you know, from the North. Here's freedom of speech, literally, you know, beaten on the Senate floor. The other is a sense of honor, having been insulted, that one is retributing honor. Mm-hmm. And you see a very different understanding sectionally of what's happened.
Right. Is it fair to say, for the reader to take away the notion that certainly and very dramatically from that point forward, our nation is moving toward an irrevocable destiny of violence? It has to be fought out.
Actually, George, I had thought that's what I was going to argue, but as I got closer into it and saw how often you had incidents, and in fact, this one is the most dramatic, but there are a lot of other violence that goes on in the Senate and the Congress that's pretty amazing. What I discovered is, except for Lincoln being president, I changed my opinion that it amazes me that we got into the war instead of compromised again. Despite these huge differences, they had always been able to work out a compromise.
Right.
Always, and Southerners were always bluffing. I think it's Lincoln's sense of himself as a Southerner and his sense of honor that cannot allow him to let South Carolina go. You might remember William Seward, the most radical, is saying, well, let them go. And what would have happened? I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah. You know, you're right, because the South is all, and the North is always compromising with the South's wish to preserve its, quote, peculiar institution. But there's an interesting argument you bring out in that respect, Vernon, here, that the South kept raising the ante.
That's right.
And this is the first time I'd ever seen this really this well developed, that it wasn't just a question of preserving slavery. You had to extend slavery to preserve it so that the fate of slavery in the territories gets to be very acute, and the entry of California as a freer slave state. I mean, all this seems to be, it just couldn't be where it was. It had to go up further.
And you've put your finger on the exact crux of the matter. If you look at it, it's so ironic that Abraham Lincoln was willing to sign a 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment would have preserved slavery where it was. So think about, we have the 13th Amendment now that ended slavery. Lincoln was willing to sign one that said slavery would not be touched in the states where it was. But the matter of the difference is very clear there, and it's very subtle. But Lincoln is not willing to let it extend. He really thought if it could be contained, then it could be made to die out. So he and white Southern slave owners actually felt the same way, I think, about it, that if it were maintained and not able to extend, it would be ended. And that was in line with Lincoln's understanding of what the Founding Fathers had wanted all along.
Now, you bring, you know, once again, Vernon, as you do in this book, you bring me right to the point of my greatest curiosity, the nature of Abraham Lincoln at the core of this, the things he believed and the way that he was able to act on behalf of a greater vision. Talk about the essence of this man and his belief, because as you point out well in this book, here's a man who harbored the customary racial attitudes of his time, yet deplored slavery, and also had this fundamental belief in the Declaration of Independence. How did he combine all of those things to act as he did politically?
Well, first I want to say that Lincoln is one of those amazing persons who grew. And he also grew in office. He didn't stand still in his thinking. And there's no doubt he was part of a racist culture, used language, the things that were racist. But I think always he was ahead of America. And by the end, he was so far ahead, I would argue that he was trying to bring America even further. And I'm getting ahead of the story. But when John Wilkes Booth hears Lincoln's speech a few nights before he kills him, and he says, this means, he doesn't use these words, but African-American citizenship. I'm convinced he was right. Booth was not crazy. That's exactly where Lincoln was going, full citizenship. Mm-hmm. And just as he had done about slavery, and this is just an example. As you know, I have done quite a bit of expert witness testimony for minorities and voting rights cases. And there's something called a totality of circumstances. And I think when there's no smoking gun, you can make a very good totality of circumstances case for Abraham Lincoln moving in this direction. If you'll go back to the criticisms of Lincoln about emancipation, and when he particularly focused on the letter when he replies to Garrison to the 20 million and says, you know, if I could save the Union by freeing no slaves, or half, or part, which is what he does, or all. And everyone says, well, see, it's all about the military. It hasn't. He has already, at that time, decided to do the Emancipation Proclamation. He's told people. So he's already there. What he's doing, I am convinced, as a masterful politician, is bringing the rest of the nation to where he was. And I think it's exactly what he was doing about full citizenship for African Americans, certainly the vote. And people understood that.
And if he's bringing people along into this vision that is growing in his own mind and character, Vernon, it seems to me it has a fundamental association with the Declaration of Independence and an ultimate belief in equality. That
absolutely
might have been a too bold word to use at the time, but that was probably where it was there.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I have argued that myself included, most of us has looked particularly at the Civil War in the 19th century as about emancipation. But I think the way that it makes the most sense is look at the Civil War as about freedoms, that emancipation is just one place on a continuum of freedoms. One scholar has pointed out there's 200 definitions of freedom and liberty at the time of the Civil War. What it meant to be an enslaver of other people and think that is your liberty to do that versus an enslaved person and what you think liberty is versus someone who owns a huge factory or someone who works in it, and you know, you can go on and on, makes a huge difference.
Right.
And Lincoln's, I think, greatest contribution is putting into the constitutional personal liberty, and basically what I think he has done is taken the Declaration of Independence and put it into the Constitution. Before the 13th and 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights restricts what government can do, and the 13th, 14th, 15th makes it a positive thing, the rights of freedom,
This is literally, as he himself said, a new birth of freedom.
That's right.
You depict Lincoln with a very memorable phrase in this book. I shall never forget it, and I want you to enlarge on it now. Another aspect of his personality, his character and being that I think you describe as fundamental is the fact that he was, and I quote, a Southern yeoman. Tell us about what that would mean in terms of this man. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, the whole area, this particular region that really needs to be studied more, Southern Ohio, Southern Indiana, Southern Illinois, Missouri, so many people had migrated from the South there. Lincoln's family migrated from Virginia to Kentucky, where he is born. The father hates slavery, as does Lincoln always. That doesn't mean he's an abolitionist. In fact, he's not an abolitionist. That's different. But he hates slavery. They moved into Indiana to get away from it, and finally to Illinois. Interestingly enough, a lot of other white Southerners moved to that area as well. And they moved because they wanted to get away from African Americans. That is racist, totally racist. That's different. So you have this mixture of people in this whole area, but they're all, I think, Southerners who have moved away from the South for various reasons. And Lincoln is so much a part of this. You know, Gone with the Wind and the images we have so distorted what the South was that we think of Southerners as these large plantation owners when there is, you can't call them middle class, but there's a lot of yeoman, small farmers, as well as some who are fairly large and others, and something of a middle class, including attorneys. And the kind of someone once said to me, well, Vernon, he was an attorney. How can you argue that he's a Southerner? And I said, well, this was a well-worn path for many poor white Southerners or middle class to move into an elite is to use the law. In fact, McDuffie, who was a leader of nullification more than Calhoun. It was exactly the same thing. So Lincoln follows this path and particularly is tied to a sense of honor that's associated with the South.
Exactly. At the end, not the end of the story by any means, but at the end of Lincoln's life, of course, his life ends with the assassination. And you, in a phrase I actually copied down because I thought it was so remarkable, and I want you to explain it for us, you describe that as, and your words, Vernon, a blow from which the United States has never recovered. Just elaborate on that briefly.
Well, again, if George, if I were a prophet, I'd make a lot more money than I do as a historian. So take that with a grain of salt. But a lot of people, I really do think we'd have had a different America if Lincoln had lived. I really think, as I said, the view of Lincoln and race would have made a huge difference, particularly if you tied that into his fundamental belief that you had to have the rule of law. Mm-hmm. It's so central. I mean, it's so similar to Martin Luther King Jr.'s and a lot of other civil rights movement people who worked to get the law changed. This is exactly what Lincoln says that one has to do.
Right.
But if you break outside the law, then you can have anarchy. So when white Southerners manipulated the laws after the war, when so many former Confederates used terrorism, mm-hmm. violence, extra-legal means, that's something that Lincoln, with his sense of decency and fair play, I just do not believe he would have stood for. He never did before, and I don't think he would have then, and he would have had the gravitas as
right.
Father Abraham, Savior of the Union, to have made it different.
You know, this once again, you bring us to a very pivotal point, because you mentioned awful wave of terror and bloodshed and repression that swept the South after the Civil War. But I think it's also important to mention something, Vernon, that I thought was brought out in this book that I hadn't seen elsewhere. Prior to that wave of violence, which begins roughly in the 1870s, there was a great deal of success that you associate with Reconstruction. And I don't think I've ever seen it quite as depicted here, that there was, and this I think was remarkable, in the Old South itself, there was a substantial movement toward at least the beginnings of a biracial democracy. I think that's something, as I say, I haven't heard before.
That's right. I argue that we have looked too much at Washington, D.C., or the state capitals, that if you look at the local area, that Reconstruction, as opposed to its way has been depicted as failing, was in fact a success, so much a success, mm-hmm. that the reason it had to be overthrown illegally through terrorist and illegal tactics is because it was successful, that interracial democracy was working. And in fact, you look at former Confederate heroes who were supporting black rights. From
General Longstreet, for example.
The
Mosby.
Gray Ghost, Mosby here in Virginia. Wise, the governor who hung John Brown. Mm-hmm. Wise's son becomes a civil rights lawyer. It's an amazing interracial cooperation, the acceptance of law, just as Lincoln thought it would be, that people would accept the law.
You know, that makes you sad for what was lost. I mean, the opportunity we could have abridged history, in a sense, of all the pain that's come. Because ultimately what happened was, and I think by the 1890s, the book is pointing out that the country effectively disenfranchises its black citizens, north and south, basically. And so you have, and actually that's a very, very sad outcome, because we have Jim Crow is introduced as a result of this.
You know, there's one other thing I want to add to that, though, that sometimes gets overlooked in the book, George. You know, I point out just how racist Illinois is, the Midwest. They are laws to keep African Americans out. There's a famous case where Lincoln, in fact, defends someone who's been accused of being African American because he cannot be in Illinois if he's a free African before the Civil War when he's an attorney. You follow that. But there's also idealism that comes out of the Civil War that helps make it a success. And this idealism doesn't all die out. So when the slaughterhouse cases, when the civil rights cases sort of undo the 14th and 15th Amendment nationally, states like Illinois, Iowa, which Grant called the bright and shining star and appealed to Lincoln's legacy to be the first state to enfranchise African-Americans outside of the South and give African-American men the vote. Minnesota, Michigan, they pass their own state laws guaranteeing integration mm-hmm. and service and things. And, you know, this is something I think has been overlooked when we think about the great migration of African-Americans to why do they go to Chicago? Why do they go to Illinois? We think, well, they're getting a away from, but there's also this rule of law again that's a legacy of Lincoln that is a place to go where, even if it doesn't live up to it, there's that law to appeal to.
You know, it's this is all such rich stuff, Vernon, and I think in fairness to the book, I should also point out that everything we've been talking about in terms of slavery, the Civil War, the end of slavery, Reconstruction, also exists in an even broader context of there's a welter of things happening in this country in the wake of the Civil War. I mean, it was, as you point out, a war financed by debt. We have the definition of industrialism, capitalism, westward expansion, the rights of women. I mean, all these things are really in a very fervent way boiling up in the 19th century, aren't they?
Exactly, exactly. The creation of trust. And this is what I try to show as both the legacy of Lincoln, and, you know, people have teased me, a number of folks, well, Vernon, I thought you actually did quantitative history, too. You didn't know the age of Lincoln, you know, he dies and you keep the book going for another how many years, 40, 50 years. But I think it's important, as it seems, of Fulcrum, where does his legacy go? Both where it is the idealism, the goodness that we claim to, but also where it's perverted, where it has been perverted in ways that we hadn't thought about. And I think that's important to look at it in both ways.
What about the it's kind of a the book, toward the end of the book, we get kind of the beginnings or the nascent beginnings of progressivism.
That's right.
Speak to us a bit about that and how that ties to the Lincoln legacy.
Well, what I tried to do to bring the book to a conclusion, you began about the millennial age, George. The millennial age was about perfecting society. And I think the election of 1896 with the populist, in some ways, to me, symbolizes the end of this idea of we can perfect society, as well as we have great faith in the common man to make the right decision, do the right thing.
You mean things have come full circle?
That's right. Well, they were calling for this, and I think it's the end because they fail. And I think Lincoln believed that. One of the great things about Lincoln is his belief that he could convince other people if he had the chance to explain it to them. You know, the famous stories of Lincoln-Douglas debate, even before that series, he once debated Douglas, and Douglas had spoken 3 or 4 hours. Everybody was hungry. They wanted to go home tired. And so Lincoln says, well, it's time for me to speak, but I want to have my say. Now, everybody go eat and then come back. And then I'll let Judge Douglas, you know, speak and rebut everything I said. And he said, I know you think that's strange, but he says, I want to convince you of what I think is right. And the only way I can do that is let Judge Douglas skin me alive, because I know you'll come back to see that. It was as typical of Lincoln, humorous, but he meant something about that. He believed in the goodness of people to convince them if they just knew. And I think that was part of it. The progressive era comes about, and it is a time of turning to experts, turning to those college professors, turning to experts to run government, restricting franchise, not trusting common people to make the right decisions.
This is interesting stuff.
And I think that that's why I sort of use that transitional shift from the populist, who also, in addition to the sense of millennial perfection, also were the last sort of political party for some time to focus upon the rights of African Americans, which is central to understanding what I call the age of Lincoln as this all plays out.
This is very rich stuff, Vernon. Is it, for example, well, you tell me if this is a correct interpretation of what you just said or not, but that by 1896, the country, under the guise of progressivism and other strands, had begun to emphasize material progress over heavenly perphection.
That's almost a phrase I used. Close to it.
That's exactly what I felt.
So I said clean hands over over sort of feminized sensibilities, that people can work their way up, these sorts of things.
And that, as opposed to Lincoln's view of the perfectibility of the common man, you could put your faith in the people, and
it goes back, as you said, to the Declaration. All men are created equal, and with education, with rights, with property, with the opportunities there that meritocracy will reward out. Very different as opposed to who should be able to vote and whose meaningful vote counts or doesn't count. How it does is a whole different way of thinking. I think we shifted quite a bit. And that's part of coming out of the Civil War, with needing experts, needing bureaucracy, one of those legacies that were unleashed.
Now, as a result of that shift, which you so well depict, Vernon Burton, at the end of the 19th century, what did that make the business of the 20th century to be? In other words, what portion of the Lincoln vision went unfulfilled and left to us to deal with it that we may still be wrestling with in our time?
Well, clearly the disfranchisement you spoke of earlier, mm-hmm. that basically African Americans disappear to the general political landscape. They are disfranchised. That's one of the things. The other is this sort of unfettered capitalism progressives deal with somewhat, the extremes in wealth that have grown out of the Civil War era, that Lincoln clearly needed industry to help win the war, taxes, these sorts of things to give special circumstances. One of the great lines, I think it probably got axed out at some point in the book, but it's on my website where I've tried to put notes and discussion, because I really see this a dialogue continuing, is a great quote by General Grant, who in a letter to a former Secretary of the Navy talks how while they would let him use troops to put down labor uprisings, he was forbidden by Congress to use troops to go in and protect African-American soldiers who had fought for the Union and their rights in this terrorist campaign that went on in 1875, 1876, and even afterwards. As we talk about a war of terror today since 9/11, African-Americans literally lived in a terrorist society, particularly after Reconstruction and at the end of it, up until at least 1965, and the Voting Rights Act, that we sort of come back to the rights of African Americans and writ large minorities in our democracy and what it means.
Our democracy and what it means. That could be a subtitle for this book, Vernon Burden. Thank you for being with us here
today. Thank you, George.